Real stories, real change, rooted in the power of nature. You're listening to Unearthing Optimism from the Arbor Day Foundation. Hi, I'm Dan Lamb. Today we're joined by someone who helped an entire generation fall in love with science, Bill Nye, perhaps the most recognizable science communicator around. Bill has spent decades making scientific topics fun, understandable, and urgent for audiences of all ages. In this episode, we'll talk through how he became Bill Nye the Science Guy, his dedication to the next generation, and why he feels optimism and action go hand in hand. Bill, welcome to Unearthing Optimism. It's great to have you with us today.
It's so good to be here, there, with you.
I'm excited for this conversation. You are such an interesting person, an influential person. I've got loads of things I want to cover with you in our conversation. And my understanding as we were preparing for this is you were trained as a mechanical engineer, which it's not the most obvious route to public television or a children's science show. So do you mind for our listeners just backing us up a little bit? And how did you start down this path?
First of all, I had a fantastic physics teacher in high school. And that through that combined with some sort of mistake in the admissions department at Cornell University, I went there and majored in mechanical engineering because I like bicycles and I really like airplanes. I think they're amazing gizmos that people build. So then the guy who had been my freshman roommate, senior year, he went into material science, I went into mechanical, and he came hurrying to my house. We each had housemates. We lived back to back in Ithaca, New York, and rented houses. He says, "You got to see this. You got to come see this." And he had this extraordinary new technology. He had cable television. And he said, "Look at this guy. You got to see this guy. It's Steve Martin at the boarding house." This video that they would replay on, I guess at that time, is be what we now call HBO on a loop or regularly. And then he says, "Look at this guy. He's just like you." Well, then a year later, Steve Martin was so popular. How popular was he? He was so popular. We had a Steve Martin lookalike contest. And a whole new, completely separate, different set of friends in Seattle had me encourage me to enter this contest. And I won. I mean, respectfully, I won. For you Venn diagram people, it was Bill Nye and not Bill Nye. That's all it was. But then they flew me to San Francisco and I did not win. I lost to the guy who eventually was the runner-up, the second place, Mike Berman, who's still a friend of mine. And after that, people want you to do stand-up comedy. So I tried that a little bit. And then I was a young guy. I was new in town. I was a United Way big brother. And I was also a volunteer at the Pacific Science Center. It's still there. It was built for the 62 World's Fair. That would be everybody 1962. And so I was on weekends a science explainer, which was fun, pouring liquid nitrogen around. So this guy who was the program director, that's everything but news, at KING in Seattle. Seattle is in King County, KING television. See what they did there?
Sure,
what happened there?
Yeah.
He said, "I want to have a comedy show." So I started writing for a show called Almost Live. And one night we needed to fill 6 minutes. The story goes that Geraldo Rivera didn't show up. I think it may have been somebody else, but let's say it was Geraldo Rivera. This is back when if you'd written a book, you'd go from city to city promoting your book. So, Bill, can you do something? Yeah, so I did the household uses of liquid nitrogen because we all have liquid nitrogen around, of course. Most of what's between you and your television screen, your computer, your phone is nitrogen. It's very safe, but it looks freaking dangerous. So I did the household uses. I chewed marshmallow, steam comes out of my nose. And the guy who's still a dear friend of mine, Ross Schaefer, in the writer's meeting said, "You know, you could be Bill Nye, the science guy." or something. So after that night in 1987, I went, this is it, man. I want to have a kid show about science akin to Mr. Wizard from when I was growing up. But I just remind everybody, it took years and years. I quit my day job October 3rd, 1986, roughly, to try this. And I had $5,000 in the bank. And I figured I could go 6 months without doing anything, without changing anything. I had a mortgage and a condo. Without changing anything, I could go 6 months. And if it didn't work out trying to write jokes, I could go back to engineering. This is in the early days of computers, man. If you screwed around for a year, I thought I couldn't get back on board, you know? So that's, it just took a long time.
You were in Seattle at the time?
Yeah, my first job, my first grown-up job out of engineering school was at Boeing. And I just like to remind everybody, if you're ever on a 747, still flying, I was very well supervised. Don't worry about it. Everything's cool. Well, nose wheel steering on 737 a little bit.
You know, becoming an influencer doesn't just happen. It takes a lot of vision. It takes passion. And I was blown away when I was looking at your book, Unstoppable, and saw your Rules of the Road for Bill Nye the Science Guy. It was so cool.
Oh, you printed it. I love it.
Yeah. So this objective, change the world.
Still the objective.
And it says to produce a TV show that gets kids and adults excited about science so the United States will again be the world leader in technology, innovation, and sound management of the environment. Then you go into the Rules of the Road and talk about your vision for this. And I'm telling you, a lot of people say they want to inspire the next generation of people and kids, and you did it. Where did that belief come from? Where did that courage come from?
Well, the courage. After I quit my job, October 3rd, 1986, I was still making a living as part-time as an engineer. I would do the expression, especially in those days, I was a contract engineer. So in other words, I worked in parallel. So the word courage, a little bit. But the big thing that happened, everybody, in a different era, it was really led by Tipper Gore, Al Gore's wife at the time, who wanted to have educational programming on television. Because at that time, especially children's television had become sort of advertising for toys. And if you were a kid watching Spider-Man, that was cool if you could get a Spider-Man action figure. I mean, that was cool. But she pointed out, as Mr. Minow, Newt Minow, said, television was a wasteland. Hmm. And anyway, we had this idea, and I say we, it was me with my friends Jim and Aaron, who were producing on a show called Seattle Today, and they wanted to start their own company and do something cool. We had this idea at the same time the government and all these production companies, Walt Disney, Public Broadcasting, were looking for the idea. We had, we took advantage of an opportunity, I got to say. We were at the right place at the right time. When the Children's Television Act was passed, and then a year later, we had this idea. We had a presentation, and we got the contract to do the show.
Well, I tell you, though, it did take a vision. It did take a courage. And indeed, you influenced an entire generation. As a matter of fact, when I told people around our office or just outside of my office even that I was having you as a guest on the podcast, people were excited, all kinds of excited, all different age groups, really excited. And oftentimes they shared stories with me about their, as they were students and they remembered teachers rolling out the TV to watch. I know you know. And even just a couple of days ago, I was talking to a team member and she said to me, these are her words. She said, you knew something important was happening that day when the TV came out with a Bill Nye video. I thought that was pretty cool.
One woman's important is another teacher who just as soon put on a video instead of put a lot of energy into it that day. So all good. And it's amazing. And I say all the time, I try to get it. I try to understand the influence of the show. It's sort of a fourth generation of students who are watching the show. And this is at a time when the electric internet is everywhere, and there's all kinds of educational everything. You can look at YouTube, for example, and learn all kinds of remarkable things. But what may set the Science Guy show apart from the other shows was the discipline in the vocabulary, discipline in the so-called learning objectives. And the learning objective is a technical or educator word that means something you can test. At the end of the 28 minutes, you can ask the viewer, what did you get out of this? And then we're hoping, we've worked hard, so that the viewer says, humans and dinosaurs did not live at the same time. We know dinosaurs live because we found their fossil bones. If they get the rest of it, that's cool. But that's what we want them to get, those two learning objectives.
I think you did a good job, and you had people paying attention to science in a unique new way. So when you meet adults who say things to you like, you made me love science, how does that land for you?
Well, it's amazing. I mean, it's overwhelming. It's a little bit hard to believe, but I've heard it a lot. And I just tell people, put my heart and soul into this thing, man. I mean, I worked as hard as I could for 5 years to create those shows. I was the head writer. I was in the on-camera department, the OCD, as I like to say. And I was a producer. I mean, I did a lot of coming up with ideas-ing.
I'm sure you learned along the way, too. It feels like there's been an evolution of the message as well as your audience has matured alongside of you. The kids have grown up, and you said generations and generations are watching now, but it also feels like the stakes have changed over the years. And well, how intentional is it just me, or has your messaging evolved as the years and the stakes have changed as well?
Well, everybody, the Science Guy show is aimed at people who are in fourth grade. People who are 10 years old, fourth grade U.S., 10 years old. In Europe, it might be a different reckoning. But this is based on research. We had very compelling research that 10 years old is about as old as you can be to get the so-called lifelong passion for science. And that I'll stand by that research is accurate. But after that, There's a lot more science to know about. You're in Nebraska, right? With the crop technology there it feeds the world.
Yeah.
And then we have all kinds of stuff that's going on in space. We might find evidence of life on another world in the next even less than 10 years. There's a lot more to know than elementary science for fourth graders. So like the book you referred to earlier, I'm very proud of those books, man. Very proud of those books. They're ideas that are beyond elementary science. So yeah, I've evolved. But through all this, what's still true, I claim when you become scientifically literate, when you study nature, you become an environmentalist. You become concerned about humans' effect on the environment and our future, and you especially get concerned about climate change. If you look at the IRV, the 100 Science Guy shows, if you count the two versions, one for Saturday morning, one for PBS, Saturday and Sunday morning, one for PBS, there's 200 shows. We mentioned climate change 6 times, even in 1993, 4, 5, 6, 7. This is an old problem, and we're doing less and less about it now. So I am hopeful that people will turn around.
It almost feels like you're not only helping people understand science anymore, but really using it more and more as this call to action in many ways. And we are facing a lot of challenges today. There's no question about it. At the Arbor Day Foundation, we know part of the solution is nature, and part of it is trees and forests, managed, healthy, thriving forests. You have said clean water, reliable renewable energy and global internet access are some of the biggest levers.
Wow, you read the book. I love you, Mom.
Where for you do you see nature-based solutions like forests and ecosystems fitting into the framework?
One of my favorite things is the alliterated phrase, trees are columns of carbon. And it really is, it's really hard to believe at first, but what most of a tree is made of comes right out of the air. Trees are made of the carbon and carbon dioxide. It's just, you might intuit, you might think, well, that material comes up through the roots and then gets in the tree, gets in the plant, and then becomes the plant. Up through the roots, right? Up through the roots. No, comes right out of the air through photosynthesis and becomes the polymers, the proteins, the things that give the chemicals, rather, that give the tree its structure, the lignin and the cellulose. It's really, it's, if that doesn't like freak you out, like what does? So when you look at a tree, you're looking at a column of carbon, and you, that carbon came out of the air. So when we cut down an extraordinary number of trees without replacing them, it's not rocket surgery. You're going to come out behind. You're going to have less carbon stored in land masses.
Well, we know that science is guiding us more than it ever has, science and technology, not only in where we plant, but why we plant. I mentioned, you talked about clean water. I know 75% of the world's fresh water supplies originate on forest lands that have to be restored and protected. And it is, thankfully, science and technology that can guide us to where we can make the biggest bang for the buck for the trees we're planting. But it's planting and monitoring and verifying to make sure those trees continue to survive. And so we are counting on science a lot at the foundation. You, of course, are Bill Nye the Science Guy. You'll always be Bill Nye the Science Guy. Space is clearly a passion for you as well. Do you mind telling us a little bit about the Planetary Society for our listeners so they know a little bit more about the organization and how they might be interested in engaging?
We are the world's largest independent space organization. We do at least three things. We educate people about the scientific exploration of space. We work to keep the Earth from getting hit with an asteroid. Very low probability, very high consequence event. The only preventable natural disaster. And then the other thing we do very successfully right now is advocate. So we advocate for the scientific exploration of space. We had 300 people. We had the Planetary Society led 20 science organizations, and we went to Capitol Hill, and we had a big outdoor meeting, and then we split up into groups, and we went to congressional offices, and we convinced these guys and gals that they got to fund space exploration, and they pushed back completely on the president's budget request, the PBR, just set it aside and restored funding for science, scientific exploration of space. And I claim it's all us. It's all the Planetary Society. So check us out. So as I said, through some sort of mistake, I went to Cornell University. And I took one class from this famous guy, Carl Sagan. Took one class. Had a tremendous effect on me. 3 years later, he and two other colleagues started the Planetary Society because they felt that public interest in space exploration was very high, but government support of it was not, was waning. And that is true today also. So it was Carl Sagan, Bruce Murray, who was the head of the Jet Propulsion Lab at the time, during the Voyager missions and Viking first landings on Mars, and Lou Friedman, who's still around, who's an orbital mechanics guy at Jet Propulsion Lab. And we have, depending on the week, 50,000 members around the world who think scientific exploration of space is cool. and they support us. We engage governments around the world, and we supply educational material, and we work hard to keep an asteroid from hitting us. You can join. It's a member organization, planetary.org. Turn it up loud.
What has studying other planets taught you about how rare and how fixable some of the problems we're facing today on this planet are?
Well, the tremendous insight, you guys, I'm so old. How old are you? I'm so old. I remember the what's called Earthrise. It's a photo taken by astronaut Bill Anders on the eve of Isaac Newton's birthday, also known as Christmas Eve, where he captured the moon in the foreground and the Earth in the icy blackness of space. And when you set the iris on the camera for the Earth, you don't see any stars. Just, you don't see any stars. And I spoke with my grandparents about this image when they were alive at the time. And they said the thing that surprised them were the clouds. You know, when you grow up looking at a classroom globe, there are no clouds. Or there's a couple of models of globes that have clouds, but in general, the political boundaries only, no clouds. And the other thing is you don't see the atmosphere. The atmosphere is so extraordinarily thin. And when you look at that image and then other images from space, you really come to understand that the Earth is a planet like Mars and Venus and Saturn, Jupiter, only different. The Earth is unique. It's the only place we know of that has living things. And it's because of all kinds of interacting forces on the Earth. The atmosphere, the ocean, the living things all affect the ecosystem around the world. Apparently, the geology that we all take for granted today includes the slipperiness of tectonic plates induced by plankton on seafloors. As these plates slide over each other, the plankton is a lubricant. It's really, you're joking me. And I say plankton, let's call it detritus, plankton that have fallen to the seafloor. It's just the interaction of Earth's systems is literally hard to understand, but it's also a little bit hard to believe. And so when we compare any of these other planets to Earth, we realize Earth is unique. It's the only place we can live, and we can't mess it up.
What are some of the biggest signs of progress that you see for the planet right now? Where are some of the signs of hope and optimism that you're feeling and or learning about recently?
Say what you will about China and the Chinese government, Chinese systems, but they are creating renewable energy systems very, very quickly. You know, apparently their electric vehicles are the best in the world. I'm not saying that's the answer to everybody's problems, but it's the kind of technology that could help everybody in the world. When you go to China, every building has a solar hot water system, not because they're a bunch of hippies, because it's cheaper, the sun's free. And so these sort of technologies, making these technologies available to everyone in the world, will allow us to do this mythic thing, which is not to do less, but to do more with less. That's what we want to do, is do more with less for more people. This is all a very solvable problem. In general, it involves technology, sure. We're capturing the sun's heat, capturing the sun's photons, making electrons move around. But to talking about the Arbor Foundation, it involves policy. Policies that enable forests to thrive and people who live near forests and enjoy forests to thrive. And these are decisions that we can all make. And when you ask what makes you optimistic, well, that people around the world are aware that this problem is important and that it's worth solving and it's solvable.
Well, you know, the podcast is called Unearthing Optimism. So we do like to bring some hope, some optimism to the conversation. We're not naive. We know there's loads of challenges for sure. But I saw a speech you gave one time, and you said, pessimistic people don't get very much done.
No, you got to be optimistic.
Yeah. Where does that come from for you? Were you born that way? Did you have to teach yourself to be more optimistic? Where does that optimism come from?
Some of each. You guys, I don't know if you heard about this. The two teams that go into the Super Bowl, neither one of them think they're going to lose. I mean, they both, and it's not, they're not delusional. They study the film, they lift the weights, they do all this stuff to prepare, but they don't go into the game thinking they're going to lose. You've got to be optimistic. Doesn't mean you are Pollyanna or tune out. It just means you pay attention and get her done.
Well, we appreciate that optimism, including as we look at the state of science today. At the Iberty Foundation, we feel and hear a lot of optimism and interest in science as we do our work. People learn at a very early age, trees help clean air, clean water, but they're also helping address huge issues like heat, water quality, air quality issues. And so we see that in many ways. It's the time for trees. If ever there was a time to be planting trees and managing forests, now is that time. You have lived through multiple waves of optimism and pessimism about science and the future. And I'm curious where you think we are right now as a community, as a society, and embracing science.
Well, there's an anti-science movement here in the U.S. like none I've ever seen. I'm of a certain age. I remember the Apollo era very well. I'm so old. How old are I? I'm so old. I remember when Alaska became a state and Hawaii became a state. I was a little kid, but I remember it. And in that optimism during the Apollo era, there was an international struggle, the U.S. versus the Soviets. Somehow it became presumed that whoever got to the moon first was somehow had won. And that optimism led to success and all these technical innovations that we embrace today. Uh-huh. And the former Soviet Union kind of went out of business, but in a way. But the United States right now is this embraced anti-science, I think, is kind of a shortcut. People are afraid of the future, and so they're afraid of science. Now, I'll tell you guys, there's two things that keep me in the game. There's a lot of young people doing a lot of cool stuff. But there's two things I really want. First, do not want to get hit with an asteroid. Bad. Very bad. Don't want that. And we had the DART mission going on 3 years ago, double asteroid redirect test, and deflected an asteroid. And that spacecraft had to fly in autonomously. It was too far away to guide with radio. The delay was too long. But guided itself. It's in space. There's no sound. And deflected the asteroid. Then the other thing, I want to find evidence of life on another world, or stranger still, something still alive on another world. I claim that when that discovery is made, it will change this world. It will change the way every one of us feels about being a living thing in the cosmos. It will change us. And we do it for a tiny fraction of any federal budget. It's tiny. And so if we could make these discoveries, it would be extraordinary. And it would be inspirational. And it would give everybody a new respect for our place in space.
You made a career out of engaging with young people. And you did it in such a way that was at their level. It's part of your rules of the road, is like talking to children and youth as peers. And I'm wondering,
you got it, man. That's it. That's the name of the game. So everybody on the show is a peer.
Yeah.
You and I are in this together. That's wow. I love you, man.
Well, so
this was a part of a lot of discussion.
Yeah. I love it. And I'm curious what your observations are of youth today. I mean, you've been talking to young people for many, many years. I'm curious where you see differences, where you see similarities, just what your observations are in their readiness, their eagerness to accept science, to be looking for solutions and be part of the answer.
Well, everybody. Young people are very aware of climate change. Young people are very aware of humans' effect on the environment. Young people are very concerned about the future. And there's all this concern about people looking at their phones all day and being depressed and not being unhappy. Well, kids have been unhappy for ages. I don't mean to dismiss it, but I hearken to Dion and the Belmonts and the trouble of being a teenager in love. I mean, this is an old thing. And I also take heart that Socrates complained about the youth of his day. They were disrespectful back when he was young and so on and so on. So people are pretty much the same, everyone. And young people are passionate, they're energetic, and they want to get things done. And that's one more reason I'm very excited about the future is the next election and the one after that, the pendulum's going to swing back pretty hard. And the U.S. especially will get back to work on these problems.
I appreciate your leadership so much, Bill. Really do. Over the years and the evolution of it and the authenticity that you bring to your arguments and your conversations. Okay, I'm gonna go a little bit different route here for a second. We plant a lot of trees. I've planted a lot of trees in my time. What are your connections with the nature? How do you explore and experience nature?
I like to ride my bike, and one of the things that I really like is when you're on your bicycle, you smell things, and the smell of a forest is priceless. I love it. So my wife and I are pretty good hikers. My wife is especially a good hiker. And we went to Italy, the Italian Alps.
Nice.
Not the Dolomites, not far from there. But I'd just tell you something that happened that I guess I'll never forget. We heard a cuckoo bird. You know a cuckoo clock?
Yeah.
I didn't get it that the cuckoo clock sound is based on an actual bird. Like, oh, what? Yeah. And it's way up in the trees. We couldn't see it, but you could hear it. Cuckoo, cuckoo. It was amazing. And then you're not going to have a cuckoo bird. You're not going to have a cuckoo clock. You're not going to have any of that without a forest. And you can't have a cuckoo bird on a grassland. It's not where they make a living. It's not going to be there. Yeah, not much as I love grasslands. I love
understood.
Nebraska.
Understood.
You got to have a forest. And I had a very regular experience in the Boy Scouts. I spent a lot of time camping. And then when I moved to the Pacific Northwest, I spent a lot of time camping. I did a little bit of mountain climbing, a little bit of serious steep snow climbing, and the forest is just priceless. I spent a lot of time there. I just, as I say, it's the smell that I really like.
I'm a biker as well. Are you doing mountain biking or road biking or both?
Well, I'm an old road guy, man. I'm a road guy. I'm so old, Howard. There was no such thing as a mountain bike. I mean, there was a Schwinn Stingray. It's not really quite the same thing.
I've
done a little bit of mountain biking, but I'm not hardcore like some people I see riding. We have all these right of ways. We have all this pavement. I spent a lot of time on a road bike. The other two months ago, I rode 100 miles. First time in a long time.
Bill, thanks for sharing your history with us. Thanks for sharing your journey. Thanks for sharing kind of your optimism for the future. I'd be remiss if I didn't end with a final question that we always love to ask, which is, do you have a personal favorite memory or story of a tree or a forest? You shared a great one with us from your visit to Italy, but is there any other kind of story you'd love to share about a memory or a experience with trees?
When I was in the Boy Scouts, we hiked around Virginia, state of Virginia, Commonwealth of Virginia. And one time we came up a rise and it was a grove of, I guess what we'd call Carolina pine trees. The kind of pine trees that produce tar for the Tar Heels of North Carolina University and turpentine. and the smell that we all like at the holidays, the smell of pine, the smell of evergreens. And on the ground was all the pine needles, which have a lot of tannin, acid. And it just was magical. It was like a carpet of soft needles. And the thing that impressed me was it was a grove, like these trees are in it together. They have their own microclimate. And once you're aware of microclimates, you start to see them everywhere. I mean, it starts the south-facing hill, the north-facing hill, hillside, the top, the timberline, fascinated. When I got out west, where mountains are quite a bit higher than back east, and you hike up, and all of a sudden, there's no trees. Like, we're done. This is as high as we can work right here. That is amazing. And the other thing that amazed me, especially in the Pacific Northwest, is where you see this rock fall, what the people call, I guess the Scandinavian word, talus, these broken rocks. And what breaks the rocks up are trees. The roots of the trees get in the rocks and just break them apart. And then one last tree story. I guess maybe you wanted one tree story.
That's great.
One last tree story. On a road trip during the pandemic, Liza and I were driving across the country, minding our own business, going to visit her brother who lives in Colorado. He's a big skier. He lives way up there. And we stumbled on Great Basin National Park. Great Basin, many people might describe as Nevada. It's that part of the Mountain West is this big, it's an exaggerated valley. It goes on for, I guess, in English units, 300 or 400 miles in each direction. And there were the bristlecone pines. Mm. These are trees that are 3,000 years old.
Yeah.
Everybody, there's no such thing in your experience. There's no crop. You might have an oak tree that you like. You might have a sequoia. You might have a redwood even, but they're not 3,000 years old. So Christopher Columbus, these trees were growing 1,000 years before he showed up. Before many of the First Nations people managed to get to what's now Georgia, these trees were growing. They're it's amazing. And yeah. They look like they put in the hours, man. They are gnarled. They have been weather beaten, but you're not stopping them.
No.
They're just up there, gnarled trees on top of this hillside in Great Basin National Park, and they're not going anywhere. And tell you what, human. We're going to be here after you're gone. Yeah. Enjoy the hike.
That's great. That's great. Thanks for sharing that, Bill. Bill, thank you. Thanks for everything you've done. Thanks for influencing.
Thank you.
Yeah, honestly, thanks for influencing generations of people, introducing them to science, helping them make them advocates for the environment, advocates for science. And, It's great to know you. Thanks for joining us on Unearthing Optimism. Yeah.
Thank you. Check out the Science Guy Forest show, a whole show about forests.
I've seen it. It's fantastic. You should keep talking about trees, Bill. You know them, you love them, and we love when you hear and you talk about them.
Thanks a lot. Carry on.
Let's take care.
Let's change the world.
That's all for this episode. Bill reminds us that science isn't just about facts or formulas. It's about curiosity, responsibility, and possibility. Understanding how the world works gives us the power to protect it. To our audience, thank you for tuning in to Unearthing Optimism. If today's episode moved you or inspired you, we hope you'll subscribe, leave a review, and share the show with a friend. Until next time, keep planting those seeds of hope.